Okay, this is starting on chapter 2 of the Carroll's book, and today we're going to talk about manifolds. And what I've been doing, like, we finished off chapter 1 last time, and that was what I consider the end of the review, but of course a lot of this stuff is a very, very advanced review, so a lot of this stuff from the review was stuff that was covered towards the end of, say, Jackson. And the manifold stuff, for the most part, is going to be new to pretty much everybody. And it's going to start getting into the heart of what we're going to be doing in general relativity. And so the first part of this lecture is actually going to be, well, there's going to be a lot of definitions throughout. But the first part of it is going to be sort of a little bit less general than a review. And then after that, we're going to get into some stuff that's definitely going to be new and some new concepts. And my thought on this is that, you know, this doesn't have to be a 2.5-hour lecture. So if I go through it and we're done early and there's no questions, then, you know, we leave early. If there's questions after I'm done, then I could take some time to answer them and, you know, explain things a little bit better. If you need me to slow down on anything, let me know. But, you know, the idea is for you guys to learn this stuff. So I want to start off talk about the weak equivalence principle. And the basic idea here is that you've got essentially two different types of mass, inertial mass and gravitational mass. There's nothing that says they have to be the same thing. Inertial mass is what happens when you take a mass and you accelerate it. And gravitational mass comes from a mass responding to the force of gravity. And so the way you write these is F equals ma for inertial mass, where A is the acceleration. And gravitational mass, you basically take the gradient of the gravitational potential, and that forms the basis of acceleration, for gravitational acceleration, and this is gravitational mass. And so the idea is that the weak equivalence principle basically says that they are the same.
So are gravitational mass and inertial mass noted by forces there, or is it actually?
No, it's m sub I is inertial mass, m sub g is gravitational mass. And there's a lot of work that's been done in experimental physics to actually see if they're the same.
So they could be different inside a black hole, maybe. We don't know, right?
Yeah, they could be different on Mars, as far as we know. What happens a lot in physics is, you know, we make a lot of assumptions, and we make so many assumptions that people don't even think that we're making assumptions. Like, for example, we assume that the laws of physics are the same everywhere in the universe, but we've only really observed the laws of physics locally, like on this planet, and, you know, a little bit outside. And so the further out you get, if you can't actually go there and set up your experiment and measure it, you don't really know that it's true. So how do you know that the speed of light is the same in a vacuum on Earth as it would be in the vacuum on some other planet on the other side of the universe? And you don't know, because you can't really perform that. And so when you're talking about inertial versus gravitational mass, the way you would try to measure that is you can put in, you try to equate the forces for the same acceleration or gravitational acceleration. Or you could look at something like relativistic mass increase and say, well, if you accelerate an electron relativistically to a high enough fraction of the speed of light to the point where its inertial mass is equivalent to the mass of the Earth, would it gravitate like it, the mass of the Earth? I don't know. It's very difficult to test this. And the suggestion is that there is a preferred class of trajectories through space-time for inertial free-falling trajectories subject only to gravity. And this is basically saying that if inertial mass and gravitational mass are the same and you have this thing that's just the gravitational acceleration that comes from it, then you can equate these forces. And that a free-falling object traveling through space-time is a lot like an object that's not experiencing acceleration. And if you suddenly stop that object, then you have an acceleration just like an inertial mass acceleration. And we experience that on Earth basically because the floor, we can't fall through the floor, so the floor is providing this upwards force that we feel in the gravitational field. So I know it's a lot of twisting of the words and the concepts, but that's the whole idea. Yeah.
Why do they call it the weak equivalence principle?
Because later on we're going to get to the Einstein equivalence principle, and you'll see this, the difference between them. And the reason why is because it's very weakly put together as far as how inertial and gravitational mass are the same. Why are they the same? You know, we're not saying under specific conditions or anything like that. We're just saying that they seem to be the same. Yeah.
So if I think consciously about my feet on the floor, I can feel my feet on the floor. And that's because I'm in constant free fall.
No, you're not in free fall because you're on the floor. But if you're in an elevator and, you know, and the rope snaps and the elevator goes into free fall, you notice the absence of gravity because you're used to dealing with it all the time.
Then I wouldn't feel pressure because
right.
The floor of my feet would be falling at the same time, so I wouldn't feel the pressure of the floor of my feet.
Right.
And so my point is to turn your thinking around a little bit to say the floor is constantly pushing against my free fall.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I constantly feel something.
Right. Right. You constantly feel something because it's pushing against your free fall. But if you were just free falling,
well,
you wouldn't feel that.
I'm pushed against, right?
But then it stops being a free fall because it's being pushed against.
Then it's, what is the word for that?
Normal force.
Normal force.
So I'm feeling normal force,
mm-hmm.
which gives me the illusion that I'm not moving.
Right.
It's only an appearance.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, because you're moving with the Earth and everything else. But like, if you look at this, you know, it's sort of like when you accelerate. If you're in a rocket ship, and this is sort of what's going to come about with the Einstein equivalence principle. If you're in a rocket ship or something like that, and it starts accelerating, you're standing on the floor, and it's accelerating from your feet to your towards your head, then you'll feel a force of the acceleration, and it's the same force you'll feel with the force of gravity on the ground. But if you stop accelerating the rocket, it feels just like you're free falling the gravitational field. So that's sort of where this is going to go to. And I'll go into that more as we get to the Einstein equivalence principle. So every particle effectively has a gravitational charge. And this gravitational charge is the ratio of the gravitational mass to the inertial mass, which is believed to be 1.
It's assumed
to be 1, yeah. But as far as we know, everything with mass responds the same way gravitationally as it would with inertial. And so this makes... this is not true for other forces, where like you might have something like electric charge, where one particle, say an electron, is going to respond oppositely, like say so from a positron, to the same electric force or the same magnetic field. And so they have +1 or -1 charges, where gravitationally we only have the 1 charge.
No negative mass,
no zero mass, or no zero charge. Because you can imagine if you had something where it actually responded to inertial, it had inertial mass but no gravitational mass, that would be charge 0. Or if it had gravitational mass which responded in the opposite direction, but it still had the same inertial mass, then that would be -1. So gravity is a different force in that everything has the exact same charge that we know of. Okay. And then, you know, you end up running it with something like dark matter. And we're supposing that dark matter would also have a plus one charge. We don't know, because maybe dark matter doesn't have inertia, but it has gravitational mass. Who knows?
So dark matter could be minus one, that's why we don't see it.
Could be.
That may not be why you don't see it, though.
Well, I mean, you know, there's a lot of different things. But, I mean, the thing is, when you talk about something like dark matter, it's, since you haven't observed it outside of gravitation, you can define it however you want to define it. And as far as you know, you're right. And so that's the neat thing in theoretical physics. You can create whatever universe you want, and then until you prove that that universe is completely impossible, it's still a good alternative. Now, the weak equivalence principle, WEP, says that there is no way to distinguish between being in a gravitational field or an accelerating reference frame in local space. In other words, since these two are the same, you can't tell whether you're in a gravitational field or you're constantly accelerating. So if you're in that elevator and all of a sudden the elevator's in free fall and you feel weightless, two possibilities. One is the elevator's in free fall and you're just falling down. The other possibility is that the force of gravity just stopped working. It's possible. You'll find out pretty soon, though. And likewise, you know, if you're in space and you're in that rocket ship and it starts accelerating and you can't see anything outside, it could be accelerating or it could be you landed. Who knows?
Landed on something faster than we were going on?
Yeah, like maybe you landed on a rock, you landed on a planet or something with a gravitational field. And so what's going to happen a lot when we talk about manifolds is you'll get up to the Einstein equivalence principle, which actually says that when you're not talking about a local space, you can actually tell the difference between the two. But locally, you can't tell the difference between the two, and that's why this is called the weak equivalence principle, because it's very local. It only applies locally. And so in an accelerating frame, objects move in a straight line. In a gravitational field, objects move to the center of the field. That's the big difference between the two. So if you're in that elevator and all you can observe is the inside the elevator, then you know gravity goes straight down. And it's either there or it's not. You can't tell the difference. However, on Earth, if you got the entire planet to play with, you know planets are round, right? So the direction that we're getting pushed in order to stay on the Earth and the direction that some guy in Australia is getting pushed to stay on the Earth, those two vectors are different. But they're both going to the center. So if you can look at those two different points, you can tell that you're in a gravitational field and not just in an accelerating plane. Otherwise, you guys would be
accelerating
the same direction. And so that's the difference in gravity, and that's sort of the clue to Einstein's equivalence principle. And the Einstein equivalence principle basically says that in small enough regions of space-time, the laws of physics reduce to those of special relativity, and it's impossible to detect the existence of a gravitational field using local experiments. And so this whole thing is kind of written as a, you know, to kind of bring up that but. And so if we think about it, what this really means is that, you know, the weak equivalence principle is okay only if you're talking about a small space. You start talking about a bigger space, it's going to be very different. And again, if you go far enough out, what happens is if I have my two keys here and I drop the key, it falls straight down. But if I drop both of these at the same time and you measure it very, very carefully, what will happen is you'll notice that this one is falling towards the center of the Earth and this is falling towards the center of the Earth, and they're slightly off an angle. And if you could accurately measure that difference in the angle between the two and how they're kind of falling towards each other as they go towards the center of the Earth, you can measure the curvature of the Earth.
Is that experiment been done?
Yeah. And therefore, you can measure the curvature of the gravitational field. And if you go far enough apart between the two, eventually you got one at the North Pole, one at the equator, and they're falling, perpendicular to each other. Yeah.
Let's say our galaxy. In the next galaxy over, there's some stardust. There's stardust in there, floating in there. Are those little particles in straight acceleration, or are they in a gravitational field?
They're in gravitational field.
Of the two galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing in the universe is truly in free fall, in an interactive gravitational
field. It's kind of like, you know what I call it, microgravity versus zero G on a space station, because there's always something there. It's always some kind of gravitational influence, and it's hard to get anywhere where it's just completely nullified. And so
even in the if you could find a place in the universe where the two galaxies were the furthest from each other, the stardust, the particles in between them would still be by 10 to the minus 32nd G or something.
Yeah, it'd be by some minute amount. Well, actually, that's the question, though, because that's when you get into like a quantum gravity thing. Because when the gravity field gets weak enough, is it quantized to the point where it goes from this last quantum above zero down to zero?
Like Kelvin, kind of like temperature?
Well, or kind of like any quantum state. Like, you know, when you take, you have quantum energy levels, and you have the lowest energy level, and then you go all the way to zero from there. And the question is, does gravity behave like that? And can you get such weak perturbations in gravity that they're the smallest allowable that's non-zero, and then you go to zero? And if that's the case, then it doesn't taper off and get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until it's like incredibly, incredibly tiny. It could just go, all right, last quantum level, it's zero.
But in temperature, we think it just gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller.
Right.
Because we've kind of proved that as we've tried to approach zero.
Yeah. But although you, it's still
temperature.
Yeah, but what the thing is that when you're talking about something like this, it quantizes, so the quantums can be so small that they're indistinguishable by experiment. Or even by any machine you can ever even build. Because, you know, you can only get photons that are such a high energy level, and they just can't get any higher than that. So when you bring in quantum mechanics, it could change everything. But what we're talking about here is classical general relativity. So classically, you could say, yeah, it tapers off and it reaches some level where it'll just keep getting smaller and smaller. And then if you move those little particles a hair one way, they might fall towards one galaxy, and a hair the other way, they'll fall towards the other one. You know, and it's very unlikely that it'll just sit there on the middle.
Like the Great Divide.
And it could be that, you know, that it's right there in that middle and that stable point, but it's an unstable equilibrium. And one of the galaxies moves just by a fraction of a degree, and then it's sucked in this way. So it's a lot of different things that can go on. And so the idea here in the Einstein equivalence principle is that this is for non-gravitational laws of physics, because it's basically saying the weak equivalence principle only holds for a short space. And so to get to that, you have to basically take your big curved space-time and only apply it in one little space. And it's possible to actually do coordinate transformations and everything to take any curved space-time and make it look like flat space in that one little area. And you'll learn how to do that in the course. Now, one thing you'll notice is that hydrogen mass is less than the mass of a proton plus an electron. It's just a well-known fact. And that's because the binding energy between the two has a negative mass. And
or
this...
Another way of saying that is a little bit of mass was given up for them to bind together.
Mm-hmm. And so another way of saying that is that means that the electromagnetic binding energy is actually gravitational. Because if you measure the inertial mass, and assuming inertial mass and gravitational mass are the same thing, then the inertial mass of a hydrogen atom is less than the inertial mass of a proton plus the inertial mass of an electron. And there's a thing called a pinning trap you can use to actually measure these masses of these really tiny things very accurately. And since the binding energy is less, and you can see the same thing when you have more complex nuclei of ions, and you might put in electrons and, protons and neutrons and a few electrons still, and you have a bigger and bigger, more massive ion, it still has less of a mass in its constituent parts because of this negative binding energy. And so that means that even this electromagnetic binding energy affects gravity or affects mass, and therefore, you know, assuming that inertial and gravitational mass are the same, and therefore this is kind of the whole idea of the E equals MC squared and where that came from. Because, you know, they're the same. Now, this led to the strong equivalence principle. And the strong equivalence principle is a version of the Einstein equivalence principle defined for all the laws of physics, not just gravity. Where you notice here, this is saying that you can't tell the difference between gravity and acceleration, but locally. But what this is saying is, this is just kind of a broader example for all the laws of physics. And it's basically saying that all of the laws of physics, you really can't tell whether you're locally, whether you're in this accelerating frame or this gravitational field.
That same thing you said earlier?
No, but that's just saying that you can't tell with gravity. This is saying everything. Like electromagnetism, you couldn't tell. You couldn't tell with the strong force, the weak force. Any of the forces in nature, everything is going to behave the same way, whether you're, no matter which one of those you're in. And when they say something is unaccelerated, it's the same thing as freely falling, which is interesting because it basically says you can just kind of switch from one to the other. And I guess if you want to see a little bit more about it, the Einstein, the strong equivalence principle, it's defined on page 50. And they said a theory that violated the strong equivalence principle but not the Einstein equivalence principle would be one which the gravitational binding energy did not contribute equally to the inertial and gravitational mass of the body. Thus, for example, test particles with appreciable self-gravity could fall at different trajectories than lighter particles. So, I mean, these are principles. They're not really laws, is what they're saying. And so, if you think about it, this is basically saying that the electromagnetic force affects gravity, and that's how you kind of bridge the gap from talking about the Einstein equivalence principle to the strong equivalence principle. Now, a few definitions. Locally inertial frames are frames which follow the motion of the individual freely falling particles in small regions of space-time. So in other words, they're kind of like you got a free-falling particle and your observer is following it. A differential manifold, which is what we're going to talk about a lot, is the mathematical structure used to define the space-time curvature, which is going to be used to define the paths through the curved space-time. And construction of a curved space-time, and you can construct this curved space-time and see if you get something equivalent to gravity. And this is the basic idea on how to go from these differential manifolds to getting something that's actually a theory of gravity. Yeah?
I don't understand your accelerated equals freely.
That kind of goes back to you're in a rocket ship and it's not moving in space, and so you're basically just floating around. And that's the same thing as if you're on Earth and you're in that elevator and the rope snaps and it just starts free falling, and you can't tell the difference between the two. And you can run as many scientific experiments as you want in the time you have, you still won't be able to tell the difference.
So, you're in the elevator shaft, you're free falling, you're actually being pulled by gravity.
Mm-hmm.
But you
feel weightless.
You feel weightless, so in your frame of reference, you're unaccelerated.
Mm-hmm.
or it's like floating in a pool of water.
Right.
Everything is equal everywhere around.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of weird. It's almost like the fact that we're standing on the floor and not going anywhere means we're like accelerated. But if we were actually moving through the gravitational field and freely falling, that means we're not accelerating. So it's kind of backwards with what you think it would mean.
I didn't find it one way or the other.
Yeah, but yeah, that's the way it works. So
I will always now, since this day forward, think of myself free falling, and the Earth is continually pushing against me.
To accelerate you.
To accelerate in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
To a zero point.
Yep. So if you're in a gravitational field and you're not moving, you're accelerating. Just kind of the other way. Yeah. Okay, so and move on and talk about...
One thing about the hydrogen mass.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's definitions. I would have called the binding energy as positive mass because the proton mass plus the electron mass plus the missing mass equals the hydrogen mass.
No, it would be negative because...
Well, the hydrogen mass minus this other mass.
Well, think about it like this. You've got the hydrogen mass is equal to the proton mass plus the electron mass minus something else. Or you could say plus binding energy. And so the only way that this works out is if this number is negative. So, because you can't really say, oh, this minus the binding energy, because the binding energy is all in there, yeah. So I think this is why they say this is negative, or think of it as negative mass.
It's positive,
It could be positive, but that means you have to put it on this side.
And what?
In which case, it doesn't really make sense, because you've got all that already in the hydrogen.
And in the next line, the EM binding energy affects gravity. I think I heard you say that that's equivalent to the force of gravity?
Well, it's equivalent to... Well, the reason why you say it affects binding or affects gravity is because
it reduces the gravity
of the hydrogen.
But it's not necessarily a gravity.
Well, if they're equivalent, if inertial mass and gravitational mass are the same, then it is. Because think about it like this. If your body is made up of protons and electrons, okay, and the binding energy doesn't do anything, then we know that the hydrogen atoms or the atoms in your body that are all combined together weigh less than all of the protons and neutrons if you add them all up that your body's composed of. Right? So, what that would mean then is that your gravitational mass then should be greater than your inertial mass because your inertial mass is less because you have all this binding going on. And then that would mean your gravitational mass would be more because it's actually just the total of all this stuff. So, in order for the gravitational and inertial mass to be equivalent, it has to affect gravity. It's got to reduce the gravitational effect on your body the same way that it reduces the inertial mass effect. And so the whole thing, reason why this even works is because of the equivalence principle.
But to me it seems like it's an assumption.
It still is an assumption because, again, how we know that inertial mass and gravitational mass are not the same or are the same is sort of, you know, that's kind of in a gray area of just we're kind of making this assumption that they're the same.
Oh, yeah.
But if we're assuming that they are the same, then this works. Otherwise, it would be easy to measure the difference. You could just take anything that has inertial mass and do the same experiment and see what happens.
So the error is kind of as conservative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so gravitational redshift. This is the next thing they get to. And this is sort of... All this is kind of painting the picture of why we're even talking about manifolds and why this is going to lead to gravity. So, the idea in this picture here is that if you take an object, and this is a gravitational field, so you can do this on Earth, you know. And what happens is, if you take this object and you cause it to accelerate in this direction, and you take an object and you just sit it here and it's not accelerating, you take this other object and you have it accelerate, and actually both of these would be accelerating, then what happens is this object emits some kind of light off of it at a frequency or at a wavelength lambda naught. Then what will happen is that if it emits it at time t0, then this is going to pick it up at time t0 plus z divided by the speed of light, right? Because this is z is the separation between these two. Then what happens is that the velocity, since these are both accelerating, then the velocity that this is moving at t0 when it was emitted, when the light was emitted, is going to be less than the velocity that this is going to be moving at a time t0 plus z over c later. Because in the time it took the light to travel between these two, this box accelerated from these, although these two boxes are at the same velocity, this box basically accelerated as well as this one. And so this one accelerated and moved to a higher velocity when it detected the light. Does that make sense? Okay. Well, let me illustrate a little bit better. Two objects, imagine they're just standing still. Then you emit light from one to the other, and the frequency shouldn't be any different, right? Well, what happens if this one emits light and this one is moving away from it? Then what happens is the light has a little bit further to travel, and you expect to get some kind of Doppler shift between them. What's happening here is that since these are both accelerating, equally accelerating, then what happens is the velocity that this one is moving when it emits the light is going to be less than the velocity of this one when it detects it, and therefore, since this is moving at a higher velocity than the one when it was emitted, it's going to see a Doppler shift. How much of a Doppler shift is going to come from this delta V? Where it's just saying delta V, which is the difference in the velocity from this one to this, when the light's emitted to it's detected, is going to be equal to the acceleration difference times the time that it took the light to travel. And the time it took the light to go from here to here is going to be V over C.
Is that because the lower mass lost mass when the particle of light left the room?
No, it has nothing to do with that. It just has to do with just basic kinematics. It's just because it took a finite amount of time for the light to travel.
And during that period of time, both of them accelerated to a new velocity.
And the light doesn't know anything about the thing that emitted it after the light was emitted.
That's because it's going at the speed of light.
Mm-hmm. It's gone. It's not in contact with the thing anymore.
And it doesn't matter if that thing were standing still or accelerating. Once it leaves the chute, it can only go at the speed of light.
Right.
And the other thing kept accelerating away.
It just kept accelerating along.
And so
what happens is that there is a delta V, a difference in velocity in this top detector of A, the acceleration of however fast they're accelerating, times Z over C. Okay? So, and since if you assume that this delta V is much less than the speed of light, then you can actually use this delta V to calculate the Doppler shift. And it's the same difference in velocity between these two as if this was standing still and then this one was moving at a speed delta V away from it. So you get delta of lambda over lambda naught is equal to delta V over C, which is equal to this number. And so this is the Doppler effect to first order of one particle which is accelerating, or two particles which are both accelerating when one emits light to the other one. If you set the acceleration to zero, there's no Doppler shift because they're literally just moving away from each other at a constant speed.
If the first one wasn't accelerating, would we still have the same Doppler shift in on the photon as it reaches the second particle?
No.
Okay.
But the second particle is still accelerating away from it?
Well, the thing is that they're both accelerating, so the distance between the two, z, is a constant in this case.
Okay.
In that instance.
In this case. And that's the only case we care about.
But why? Because in the other case, you still get a z. It's just a longer z.
We're not concerned with that, because the reason why we care about that is because we're going to use the Einstein equivalence principle and take this situation where you have the acceleration of both of these and just say this acceleration is the acceleration of gravity. Now, what happens is if you have a uniform gravitational field and you have a tower here, and you have some frequency that's emitted from the bottom and it's detected up here at the top, you should see the same Doppler shift. Because acceleration here is just replaced with the acceleration of gravity, and the acceleration of gravity is the same for the top and the bottom. And so the whole idea of this is the reason why we made them both accelerate at the same rate was because we wanted it to look like a gravitational field. And so if everything is equivalent, and if the Einstein equivalence principle holds, then the delta lambda over lambda naught should be equal to the acceleration of gravity times the difference, z, between the two, divided by the speed of light squared, just like up here. Where here, the acceleration of gravity is given by the gradient of the potential. And so you could say that by integrating the gradient of potential over time, that, you know, it's the same thing as taking this, and you could see that here they've basically integrated over dt, right? Because, and the reason why they did this is because all of this integral of the acceleration with respect to time is just delta v. And so from there, they're able to say, well, dt is how much time passed from the time the light was emitted at the bottom till it reached the top. And that's equal to dz divided by c. And so you can just integrate the gradient of the potential over the distance and divide by c squared, and you get the Doppler shift. But since we're just integrating over z, then we only care about how the potential changed in the z direction. So that's why you have the partial respect to z here. And then since you have partial respect to z and you're integrating over z, this is just the delta in the potential over c squared. So you get a gravitational redshift, is what they call this, caused purely by the acceleration of gravity. And that if you take, for example, a light, and it's at a set frequency, like say a laser, and you have it on Earth, and you shoot it up into space, and you measure the frequency of the light in space as compared to on Earth, there's a difference. And it has actually redshifted by the fact that it's going up through the gravitational field. And this is a real effect. This is actually what they use in GPS systems. And they actually have to take into account the gravitational redshift of transmitted light going from Earth into space in order to calculate positions. And if an observer at the top of the tower measures frequency lambda 1, or wavelength lambda 1, an observer at the base measures a frequency lambda naught, where the two are different by this delta lambda, then what this is saying is that the time change, assuming that, you know, both of them agree that the light's moving at the speed of light, the time change at the top is equal to lambda naught over time change at the base is lambda naught over c, and the time change at the top is lambda 1 over c, which means that since lambda 1 is a longer wavelength than lambda naught, then that says that delta t1 is greater than delta t naught. and therefore the time it takes the wavelength to pass is increased. And that means that time is actually moving slower in the gravitational field than it is up there in space. Okay, so I just said a whole lot there. Two things that come out of this. One, you know, using... this is all set up to do the equivalence principle. But if the equivalence principle is true, then light gets redshifted when exiting out of a gravitational field. And two is that time actually runs slower in a gravitational field. That's why when they say when you fall into a black hole, that you time slows down. And we'll go into more details on it later on a semester, but basically you fall into a black hole, what happens is as you're being crushed and spaghettified by all the forces going on, and then you can actually feel the tidal forces between your head and your feet, and it just stretches you apart, and you're being ripped apart, time slows down, so you get to experience it for a really long time. Yeah, about 5 billion more years of this. Yeah. So, yeah, it's...
Well, if I equate a particle moving at the speed of light to a horse, and I have two trains accelerating, mm-hmm. if I drop... the moment I drop the horse out of the train, it can only run 40 miles an hour. It doesn't matter if the train's accelerating a little bit or a lot. Mm-hmm. The horse doesn't keep that acceleration.
Like right.
It just can only run what it can run.
Right.
Which is like a particle of light. It mm-hmm. runs at sea.
It runs at sea. It doesn't never go any faster, so therefore, it can change wavelength.
I mean, the appearance of it changes wavelength.
The observed wavelength
the
is different.
The observed wavelength changes. It did change. It seemed
right.
to change.
And that's a consequence of the speed of light being a constant for all the observers.
Of the observer, not the effect of this. From the speed of light reference frame, it's still at sea.
Yeah, but I mean, then again, if you really want to get philosophical, you know, what is time? And, you know, time is only something that exists for that observer. It's not a universal thing. Actually, I taught a class on undergraduate course on special relativity, and it's from that Laurent book I used. And one of my favorite parts about the book was at the beginning he was trying to define, you know, time and trying to define length and what they are and what they really mean as far as physics goes. And his definition of time is what you measure with a clock. His definition of length is what you measure with a yardstick. That's it. So if you, as long as you're measuring it, and you're measuring what you measure, that's the definition of time. There's no universally true definition outside of that. So what's happening here is this observer at the top, he measures time, and since the speed of light is moving at a constant, then that translates into having a longer frequency. Okay. All right, so this is the gravitational redshift part, and we'll go into that more later on in the semester. So... this is going to lead us to the math. And this is why we really get into the meat of general relativity. The manifold is a mathematical representation of an n-dimensional space that may be curved but looks like Rn Euclidean space in local regimes. Now, what that means is... that, and I guess they got some good examples of manifolds on page 55, where, you know, you have something that's curved, and this is where the class just kind of takes that turn and we start talking like mathematicians rather than physicists, is that a manifold could be anything geometrically. It could look like a donut or it could look like a table. And so it's just an n-dimensional space. So it's not even confined to being three-dimensional or four-dimensional. It could be 27-dimensional if you want, or 100-dimensional. And it can look like a Euclidean space, an Rn Euclidean space in local regimes, which means you can always do some kind of coordinate transformation in order to make it look flat. Like, for example, you know, if you have a globe is a sphere, which is a type of manifold. But you can take a globe, and if you just want to look at a little piece of the globe, say, you know, you just focus in on the state of Texas, you can make a flat map of the state of Texas that looks reasonable. And the smaller region you're interested in, the more accurate you can have a small, flat region it looks like. And so you're literally mapping the globe to a map. And so we can analyze functions on the space by basically mapping them to functions on Euclidean space. And so that's why we use the term map, because you know, you're literally taking this curve thing and you're making a flat map of it. And it doesn't matter what kind of surface you're dealing with. I mean, if you go back and you look at the old drafting examples or CAD examples of trying to design anything from a car to a rocket to you know, a house, all of them can be basically drawn out and mapped on a flat piece of paper that you can roll up and take wherever you want. And that's all we're doing. And so examples of manifolds are, there's first this Rn, and you use a script R to distinguish from just real numbers. And what these are basically a set of real numbers that are used to describe whatever the manifold is, but they're basically, this is a flat space. This is like the map. And you can have a, it's also considered Euclidean space, where it looks like you have a set of n dimensions, you know, to describe the manifold everywhere, where if you take R1, it's a line. R2 is a plane. R3 would be a cube. And then if you want to go higher than that, you get like a hypercube or something like that. R0 would just be a point. Sn is an n-sphere where the locus of all points are a fixed distance from the origin. And so basically, it's almost as if you take one dimension from the Rn space and you just drop it off. And this should be a script R here as well. So, for example, S1 would be a circle, where R2 would be a plane. And S2 is a sphere, because you basically got, you know, two angular coordinates describing all a distance, same distance from the center, and etc. And Tn is called an n-torus. And so a torus is basically a donut, where you can take a n-dimensional torus, and you can think of it as like you take a piece of paper and you fold it along one axis, and then you connect the tube together, and you get this tube thing. And you notice that whether all of these, basically, you can just map to a flat piece of paper. And a Riemann surface of genus GT2 with G holes instead of one. And so what that means is you can have something shaped like a donut, and it has one hole, or you can have this thing with two holes, and they have an illustration on 55. Or if you have zero holes, then you end up with something that looks like a sphere, or could look like a sphere. And so, for example, S2 is a Riemann surface of G equals zero. Continuous transformations of Rn are Lie groups. And these are manifolds with a group structure. For example, SO2 means special orthogonal two dimensions. And that's the same thing as an S1 or a circle. And basically what that means is that you've got you know, two dimensions and they're lying in a plane and it's round. SO3 would be a sphere. And so this is kind of where the group theory stuff kind of seeps in a little bit. And the direct product of two manifolds is a manifold. So if M has dimensions n, and if M1 has dimensions, M prime has dimensions n prime, then M product with M prime is going to have the dimensions n plus n prime. And so you can literally just take the dimensionality of two manifolds. You can put two manifolds together to get a bigger manifold with more dimensions.
Terminology question. N?
Mm-hmm.
Locus?
Yeah.
I'm unfamiliar.
The locus is basically means...
Center points.
Yeah. Center points or however you want to think about it. But basically, the way to think about it is that, like, if all the points on the surface have got to be an equal distance from the origin. So that's just, it's just a mathematical definition of saying, you know, to get to something like a circle or something like that. I mean, as you see the manifolds, it becomes more obvious about what we're talking about. And so the idea is that manifolds have to look basically like Rn everywhere. So anytime you have a manifold, if you zoom in on it enough, it'll look flat. That's the only requirement. And we're going to deal with manifolds that have continuous derivatives. In other words, they're smooth. And so there's no discontinuities. It's like, you know, the manifold doesn't certainly jump off anywhere. And that means that if you differentiate along the surface, you can always go from one point to the next point, and there's a continuous progression. Now,
so it won't be inside a black hole?
Even a black hole, you can do that.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, even in a black hole, anything, it just basically, you won't be in a set of discontinuous. Nothing is going to be discontinuous. It doesn't suddenly jump, like if you look at the edge of this this stage, how it just drops down to the floor.
Discontinuity.
That's a discontinuity. You couldn't have that in a manifold. I mean, you could have a smooth ramp going down, but no steps. So, we're going to deal with... here we're going to have M and N represent two sets. Okay? And these can be sets of manifolds or they can be sets of numbers. And this is the whole idea here is to describe maps, and then we'll kind of go back to manifolds. Now, phi is going to be called a map that goes from M to N. And a map could be any kind of mathematical operation. So, for example, if you want to map from a globe to a flat map, you have to have some kind of mathematical algorithm to do that. You might not think you're doing it, but, you know, there's a set process. You can take the globe and you can just peel the skin off of it and flatten it down, and then that's a map. Or you can just take, say, a set of numbers, and you can map it to another set of numbers. For example, let's say I have a set of numbers like this, and I'm going to do a map to a set of numbers like this. Okay, what's the map to get from here to here? Yeah, so this is just... X squared is the map. It could be that simple. So what happens is each one of these maps is going to basically assign an element N to each element M, or a function of the elements in a set. So as long as you can just map from one set to the other, and then you're just concerned with the map, then you can kind of, you know, forget about everything else. As long as you got the map, you know how to translate these things. And so given that phi is a map from A to B, and psi is a map from B to C, then we can have this composite map, which actually goes from A to C by just kind of linking the two together. And so, for example, if I have a map there that goes from, basically squares everything, and then I have another map that takes everything and it cubes it, I can combine those two maps together and just say I'm taking x to the sixth power, or, you know, and to go from one to the other.
That little zero degree sign is for mapping?
Yeah. Actually, this means a composition of maps, this little open circle thing. So we have, let's say, our squared map. And then the other map might be a cube map. And then this combined map is the basically those two operations put together. Then what happens is that you can actually take one map, this combined map, acting on some set A or some number A, is the same thing as having psi act on phi of A. And A is written here to be a set which exists within this bubble A here. And this is kind of the language of what that means. And so you actually could see this on page, is it on 57 or 58? Yeah, it's on 57. Where, you know, basically the language is to go from one to the other, or if something is a subset or something is contained within the set or something like that, you could see it by the symbols. And so you could see that if A, little a, exists within A, then phi A exists within B, because that's the translation of these points to these points. Then psi of phi of A exists within C, where you've gone through the whole transformation. Now, of these maps, there's different types of maps. You have to be very careful about what you're dealing with. Like, one-to-one means that each element in N has no more than one element in M mapped to it. So, for example, here, with x squared, you can go, you could see that each element on the right only maps to one element on the left. 1-2 means that each element in N has at least one element in M mapped to it. So you can actually do something like, let's suppose we had a different set here.
Is the left side N and the right side M in that particular
set? The N and the M is confusing.
No, no, no. N would be this set. M would be this set. Because we're mapping from M to N.
Well, in that case, if M can include...
Right. If you take M and you include negative numbers, then it's going to map to the same set, right? And so in this case, each element in N has more than one element in M that maps to it, because there's two different ways to get to it. So it's not one-to-one in that case.
Two-to-one?
Well, we don't even define it then.
Okay.
But they don't even, I don't think they even really have a name for it when you do that. Yeah. And on two means that each element in N has at least one element in M mapped to it, onto it. And so what that means is that you can actually develop a map in N where you don't have at least one element from M that maps to it. And there's a way of constructing a map there where, you know, like you can imagine if you're mapping from a globe to a flat 2D map, that literally there's some spaces missing when you're mapping from one to the other, and you have to kind of fill in those gaps. And that's what they mean by on two.
So your example is neither one-to-one or on-two.
Yeah, they can be neither one-to-one or on-two, or they can be both. So for example, e to the x is both one-to-one. It's 1-to-1, but it's not 1-2. Because with e to the x, for every element x is going to map to one element e to the x. And so you can go through all the positive numbers, all the negative numbers, all of them are going to just map to one other number. But it's not 1-2 because there are numbers in e to the x that do not have at least one element of m mapped to it. Okay, so for example, 0 is not going to show up there. But you can go all the way from just a little bit above 0 to almost to infinity. I mean, unless you actually have to go to infinity which you really can't do because that's not a full, you know. Another one is x cubed minus x. This is onto, but it's not one-to-one because there's multiple ways of getting x cubed minus x, but at the same time, you got a complete set here because you can basically, your x cubed minus x could be positive, it could be negative, it could be everything. And here, with e to the x, it's always going to be positive. That's why it's not 1, 2. But here, this can be negative or it can be positive. X cubed is 1 to 1 and 1, 2. Because it can be positive or it can be negative. X squared is neither 1 to 1 or 1, 2, like was this example here. Where you could see that the n column is never going to be negative. And there's multiple ways of mapping to it with the same set of numbers. And so this is what we have to look at anytime we're dealing with these maps, is what are they? Now the domain of the map is called M, which is basically short for manifold later on. And the image of the map is where the domain gets mapped to, or where it gets on mapped onto. And so you can imagine the image is the same thing like you take a picture. And you're basically mapping what you're seeing within the space into this little image you can use later. Or another example is you take a picture of a globe and you can just take a picture of that part. And that's going to be the image of the map. The pre-image is a set of images in the domain that get mapped to some subset of N, where this little symbol here means subset, where the other symbol I used earlier, yeah, just meant an element or exist in, is another way of putting it. So there's a difference between that and this. So it's basically saying that you have a set of images in M, and they're going to get mapped to a specific subset of your N, not necessarily the whole thing. And invertible means that a map is both 1-to-1 and 1-to-2. And the reason why that's important is because if you look at it over here, since this is neither 1-to-1 or 1-to-2, if I start with N and I want to go back to M, I can't do it because I don't know if it's positive or negative. And also, I've got a whole missing set of negative numbers from N, so I don't even have the full set. And if a inverse map means that you're basically going from N to M, which means that if you take these two maps and you put them together, you get back to the original. And so, you can do that with x cubed, but you couldn't do it with x squared. And you couldn't do it with e to the x because, well, you've got, it's 1-to-1, but it's not 1-to-2. So you do, I guess you could try to map backwards with something like that, with a natural log. But you're still kind of limited in that there's some numbers, like if you had a negative number, it wouldn't work because it's not 1-to-2. Now, next, so does everybody get the basic idea when we talk about maps? Okay, next thing I want to talk about is continuity. And this is why what we talk about when we say smooth. Because here, let's say phi is a map from an m-dimensional space to an n-dimensional space. And these are both Euclidean, as you can see. And this could be thought of like a projection. Like, for example, if you take something and you just do a shadow of it. Like if I take my hand and I put it under here, you just see the shape of the hand, but you don't see all three dimensions. So we're kind of losing a dimension as a way to go from three dimension to two dimension. And so if you assume a set of n functions with m variables, then you could take for every, you have all the values of x, all the positions in x which exist in this M manifold, and you're mapping them to these y's that exist within this manifold. And so you can just imagine you've got all these different maps, each one for each of the different dimensions. And so if you say something is CP, it means the P derivative of the function exists and is continuous. So in other words, if you take your mapping like this, and you just start taking derivatives, then you can take the first derivative, second derivative, whatever, and then eventually you get down to something where you can't take another derivative because it's discontinuous. Then that tells you the level of which it's continuous. The P0 or C0 is continuous, but not necessarily differentiable.
Take the derivative out of it, the derivative will be discontinuous.
So. Mm-hmm. But it's at least at that level, it's continuous. And C infinity means you can take infinite number of derivatives and it will always be continuous. And this is what they mean by smooth. So, for example, for this table, I mean, you can take as many derivatives as you want. They're all going to be zero, but they're not going to be, they're not going to blow up. And that's the thing you want to avoid, is as soon as the derivatives start blowing up, that's when you cease to be smooth. And so it's just kind of a level of how smooth these things have to be. Now, when we do general relativity, we're going to deal with these things called diffeomorphisms. And diffeomorphic basically means that you have a C infinity map, infinitely differentiable map, of to go from M to N with C infinity inverse maps going from N to M that all exist. And in here, this map is called a diffeomorphism, if you can go both ways like that. So if you have basically a space where you can just continuously differentiate it and it's always going to be smooth and you can invert it, that's a diffeomorphism.
And you're mapping into another smooth manifold.
And the reason why we need that is because if we have a curved space-time, we need to be able to map it back to a smooth, flat space-time and then go backwards. Because we know how to do special relativity. General relativity is hard. And so you always want to be able to map it to a flat space and then you can unmap it back and then you can understand all the physics going on.
So, let's see, a Mercator map is not exactly a true diffeomorphism.
Which one?
A Mercator.
Oh, yeah, that multi...
projection of the...
It's a Mercator, that's the standard one, where Greenland and Iceland are extra large and mm-hmm. Antarctica are extra... That's not truly diffeomorphic.
Right.
Because it has this, these...
Distortion.
Distortions. But maybe the map where the... I don't know what it's called, the one that has the clover... That's more diffeomorphic.
Yeah, because of the fact that you really, you would end up if it's. Let's see. It's.
What's that called?
I forget the technical term for it, but it's the non-technical term is the equal area map, where the same area on it as it does on the globe.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't remember.
Yeah, and it's a little bit tricky because you also have to say, well, it's continuous and it's complete, which means that it has to be one-to-one and onto in order for it to have this inverse map that works and everything. So you get into some kind of tough definitions. But you're right. I mean, when you have a distorted Greenland and Iceland like that and it looks bigger than South America, obviously there's some distortion going on and you can't say that that's diffeomorphic because, first off, it's not...
It's not one-to-one.
Yeah, it's not one-to-one. And, you have to put in some filler to make it work. But the way we're going to use this is basically going to be mapping any kind of general space-time. And what you'll see is in real space-time, it's always going to be continuous. Because if it wasn't, then you're walking along, and all of a sudden you're on Mars. It doesn't work.
Except you're a wormhole.
So you could say a blueprint for a house is diffeomorphic to the house?
Mm-hmm. Because...
It's one-to-one.
It's one-to-one, and it's smooth.
it's onto.
Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, it's continuous. Where, I mean, I can't say that all the angles are, you know, are rounded, but what it means by continuous is it literally goes from, it maps every part to every other part. And it's continuously, you can differentiate it, and you can see how you can go from one place to another within it.
So a newspaper is not dipping off into the news.
I think that's getting a little abstract.
Because it's not one-to-one, and it's not on-two.
Yeah, there's stuff missing.
There's a few things missing and a lot of opinion in there.
Yeah. But yeah, you can basically just say, how do you map anything to anything?
I mean, therein lies the problem with social studies versus physics.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
Well, I think one thing is physics a little bit more honest about what we don't know. But anyway, so what happens here is if you have two spaces and they are the same as manifolds, then they're diffeomorphic. And what that means is that if they're diffeomorphic, it means that you can literally map from one thing to the other and you could say that they're exactly equivalent. And they're just two different ways of looking at it. If they're not diffeomorphic, then there's an obvious, you can't say that one is real and one's not. It's like basically saying you've got the real person and you got the cartoon. And, you know, nobody looks at a caricature and confuses it with a portrait because, you know, obvious reasons. And so you can basically take a diffeomorphic, relationship between two manifolds and map one to another one, and it's like a coordinate transformation.
So we do that all the time with the shuttle. We go from Cartesian to polar, depending on...
Yeah, that's a good example, because you can literally... You're not losing any information when you go back and forth. Yeah. You're not losing any information, and everything is smoothly connected from going from one point to the other. And the reason why this has to be infinitely differentiable is because, let's say you're missing little gaps in the information, you can fill in the gaps by basically, if you know the point here, you know the point here, there's got to be one in between that's got to have that same value, or, you know, a continuous value between the two. If they're not infinitely differentiable, then you could have these little spikes or jumps or skips between it. And if you can't, if they're not invertible, then you can't go back and forth. And so by doing this, you can basically take a very complicated space and you can map it to a simple space that you can understand. And that's another secret in physics. We know how to take stuff and simplify it.
Well, actually, you're only examining that which you can simplify. And if you
right.
can't simplify it, it's not in physics. We don't even see it.
Well, a horse is a spear. What do you know? So, next thing I'm going to talk about, this is the open ball. And this is a set of all points X in Rn space such that if you take X, the magnitude of X minus Y, you're going to get something less than R. So R looks like the radius. And Y also exists in Rn space. And R is... it exists in the realm of real numbers. And so you can say, with an open ball, that you can kind of take your space and you can carve out a specific
sphere
or radius or whatever. An open set, on the other hand, is this, and basically there's no hard boundary to this ball. You can make it as big or small as you want. An open set is a set of that's constructed from an arbitrary union of open balls. So you can imagine you take these little spheres that represent part of your manifold, and you can just put them together. And you kind of say, well, this represents this part, I'm going to put it here. And then I have another region represents that part, and I'm going to put it next to it. And you can have these things overlap each other, or sit right on each other, however you want to do it. And so you could create this arbitrary union of open balls where if we say that V exists in the manifold Rn, then Y exists in V. if V is a subset of that, then Y exists in V. And there is an open set is the interior of an n minus one dimensional closed surface. So in other words, you can see you've kind of taken these little regions and you just put them together to fill up this space.
In the case where you just have the one open ball, it's a sphere with a surface area.
Mm-hmm. But you can take a bunch of them and you can throw them together, in which case you can get a bigger sphere or whatever other shape you want.
It won't be a sphere, but it'll be a three-dimensional space with a two-dimensional surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it ends up with a two-dimensional surface. Yeah. In a chart or coordinate system, it's basically where you take a subset of the manifold and a map, which is a one-to-one map that maps that subset of the manifold to your set of real numbers or your Euclidean space. An example of that is that you take your globe, and you don't have to map the entire globe to your flat map. You can just focus on just one area and map it there. And you want to have a one-to-one map in order for that to work. And so in this case, U is an open set within the manifold. And the open set came from basically just combining all these open balls. And so we just take this set from the manifold and we map it into real space with a one-to-one map. And remember, and I didn't say on too because, you know, we're only talking about this space. We're not talking about the full set. The atlas is exactly like the atlas you'd see in map making, where an atlas is an induced, an index collection of charts. So if you take all these different charts that you get from all these open balls that you've mapped to multi-dimensional Euclidean space, and you put them all together, then you get a bigger view of what's going on. And the union of the U sub alpha is going to be equal to the entire manifold. Then we say that this covers the entire manifold. And so you can basically take all your maps and you can sew them together and you get a huge map or atlas. And there's an example better drawn than I could do. Yeah, on page 60. Where you could see this, where you basically take these two different open sets in this manifold, and you can map them here to this set, Rn, through one transformation, or you could map them through this other transformation. And the gray area is the kind of intersection of those two. And, you know, it just basically depends on which map you use, and you can just put all those together and to get a chart.
They have to intersect?
No, they don't have to intersect, but
they could.
They could.
In either case, you've still got real space.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same real space.
No, it doesn't have to be. It's not the same real space.
Well, the little R sub it superscript N is the same.
No, it's just the same dimensional space. They could be different spaces. Like, for example, if I make a map of the Grand Canyon, I can map it as a flat map, or I can map it in terms of elevations of the terrain. And both of them might be the same dimensional map because they're sitting on a two-dimensional piece of paper, but they're both going to look different. And you can combine those two to give you more information about, you know, the Grand Canyon. And a C-infinite n-dimensional manifold is infinitely differentiable n-dimensional manifold is a set manifold along with a maximal atlas and contains every possible chart. In other words, you're looking at every possible different way that you can take the manifold and represent it and then put all that information together.
So if I'm in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. I can have one map that has the bus system, the subway system, the freeway system, the sewer system, the electric system.
Mm-hmm.
One huge manifold.
Well, yeah, that would basically be like Washington, D.C. is the manifold. And your atlas is that collection that you have. But in reality, you've got your subway map, you've got your sewer map, you've got your street map, you've got your building map. And so you just put all these electrical grid, everything. And if you put it all together, you contain all the information about the entire city. But if you just take one of them, you're just getting a little bit of the information. And so it's not, you don't always want to see all the information, but you have to have a way of capturing everything, and that's basically what this does.
And a way of tying them together.
Mm-hmm. And that's what the Atlas does. It's not just a collection of charts, it's an indexed collection. So it has to be a way of doing that.
So indexed, in my case, would be red for the sewer system, green for the subway system.
Mm-hmm.
Yellow for the electrical system.
Whatever works for you.
Index.
Yeah, I mean, that's
brown
a thing.
Sewer system.
Yeah, brown. So, is this going to matter in general relativity? Am I going to have multiple realities
yeah.
or particles?
Well, think about like for a black hole. You know, you've got there's a lot of different ways to represent it because. You've got what's going on at the surface of the black hole, at the horizon, what's going on inside, what's going on way out in infinity. And so you have to have some kind of way of kind of representing all that information. And so that's why we use this, is that, you know, you do and you don't. I mean, it's like you don't have to keep all this in your head at the same time, but you do have to have ways of dealing with all this stuff.
Well, I guess it's not so different from Washington, D.C., because my electrons are going at some speed, the water's moving at a different speed, the mm-hmm. subway's moving at a different speed.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so it's a lot to keep track of.
So it's the same as a black hole. You're just putting all that into one manifold.
Except for the black hole is probably simpler when you really look at it.
In a way.
Yeah.
It's got less systems.
Yeah, a lot less systems. You just got the space-time curvature. You don't even have to think about mass, really. But the thing is, they have to be a way of extending your map of the black hole all the way out into infinity and then talking about what happens with time. So we actually have maps for things like black holes, which actually extend them out to infinity in time and in space and be able to capture all this information in one map.
Well, if you're extending the map of one black hole out to infinity, then it's got a lot of galaxies that are affecting it.
Oh, in our map, there's nothing else in the universe, just the black hole.
Okay.
Just keep it simple. So, so the basic idea here in these manifolds is that we want to be able to essentially understand what a manifold is. And then once we understand what the manifold is, that's when we get to chapter 3 and we talk about curvature. And that's when you actually know what the heck you're curving. Because if you don't understand the manifold, then you really can't understand what we mean by curvature. And in the next lecture, we're going to talk about vectors again. And we're going to talk about vectors in the context of, you know, manifolds. Because if the manifold is like the space and it's going to represent the space-time, then what's a vector? And that's kind of how we go from there. All right, any other questions? Today. Okay, I think I filled your heads up enough.